Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone. This is Michael Charney. Thank you for joining us on The Middle Ground. As always, on a Tuesday evening from 8 to 9:30, I'm joined, as always, with co-host Eric Beiler. An interesting topic to discuss tonight. You know, it's kind of funny, as we get older, we think about phrases and how they change. And there are two words that will never mean, I think, the same thing to anyone as they did years and years ago. When I was a child, Tea Party meant one of two things. It either meant that my sister was forcing me to sit down and play with her when I would rather be out riding my bike or on a skateboard or something like that, but she was a little bigger and a little older than me, and if she wanted to play Tea Party, that's what we did. Or it was a reference to a scene from Walt Disney's Alice in Wonderland, which, of course, I saw before I ever read the book by Lewis Carroll, as many did. And I still remember Edwin, the famous character actor who played the Mad Hatter. And I sort of remember that scene in Alice in Wonderland of the Mad Hatter and the Tea Party. And those images, I think, for many people, are not going to be the ones that are remembered in generations to come. Instead, we have a Tea Party political movement that has become a phrase in and of itself. It means something completely different than what it did to me. It's a little bit of a feels a little bit sad to have lost a piece of my childhood in that phrase. But in any case, it does mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people these days, and some of them good, some of them not so good. The Tea Party origins are hazy. I've heard mythologies around the Tea Party having started out of the quote was the ashes of Ron Paul's 2008 campaign. I remember hearing Rick Santelli, who from CNBC, who works the floor at the Chicago Board of Trade, going on a rant one day and talking about how we should all go down to the Lake Michigan and have a tea party, throw tea in the lake the same way the tea was thrown in the Boston Harbor. I've also heard that it was originally started as early, or at least planned as early as far back as 1971, as an effort from the tobacco industry to try to increase the corporate influence on politics. But it certainly has become a phrase with weight. People have very strong feelings one way or the other when they hear the phrase. However, interestingly enough, there has been a fair bit of effort, I shouldn't say fair, but there's been some initial efforts to try to find common ground with the Tea Party and other political movements and other political orientations. Most recently, about a month ago, a group called Living Room Conversations, which is an open source project, had a meeting. And then what they do is they bring people together that you would not normally think would sit down together in literally someone's living room, and they have conversations to try to find common ground. And they had the co-founder of the Tea Party Patriots, as well as a representative from MoveOn.org, sit down together and have a conversation. And, you know, surprisingly, not perhaps to you or to me, but surprisingly to the people who put it on, who weren't sure if it was going to be even a workable hour, they actually had quite a conversation and ended up agreeing on a number of things. I have a short bullet list. So you have the Tea Party Patriots, which is arguably one of the most conservative and perhaps stereotypical, if you will, when we think of the Tea Party, and MoveOn.org, which is, again, stereotypically a very left-wing organization. And they both agreed that there was a need to reduce the influence of big business on government. They both agreed that it was time to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. They both agreed that there's probably more burdensome paperwork and regulation for government and for people to sort of work through in order to grow their businesses, and some of it very burdensome. And so there was a fair bit of common ground. And, you know, I think there's a real opportunity here, a unique opportunity as the stereotypical Tea Party weakens, and as it was weakened in the last election, and some of the original intentions of the Tea Party, which was, you know, smaller government and constitutional oversight and things of that nature, to maybe rise up a little bit and have a louder voice away from some of the big money influences and the Koch brothers and various other large industries that have sort of hijacked it, and maybe this is a time when we can start to sit down and talk. To that end, Eric Beiler and Annabel Park recently went to a rally, a Tea Party rally, in I believe it was North Carolina. There is a video from the Story of America collection that we've linked to off our website that I encourage everyone to take a look at, which is an interview with one of the leaders of that particular rally. And tonight, what we thought we'd do is in the wake of that Story of America piece and the Living Room Conversation piece, and of course the spanking that the stereotypical Tea Party took in the last election, that maybe it's time for us to talk about it as well, and see whether or not some of the people that normally call into our show and the people that we have talked to in the past who are self-proclaimed members of the Tea Party can begin to find some middle ground as well. So with that as a bit of an introduction, I'm going to bring in Eric, both Eric and Annabel, actually. I'm going to bring them in simultaneously and let them tell a little bit of their story and their experience in North Carolina at this Tea Party rally. Eric, first of all, good evening. Annabel, good evening to you. Eric, as always, good to hear from you. And Annabel, thank you again for joining. You're becoming a semi-regular. I hope you don't expect a paycheck or anything. as always, it's good to have you on the show. Eric, why don't I start with you? You were the man behind the camera. Tell us a little bit about how this began and what the experience was. Kick us off a little bit on this.
Okay, well, the most interesting thing I have to share that isn't in the video, and we're going to play a clip in a moment for those who haven't seen the video yet, is that after a couple of hours of listening to speech after speech that was framed in the same way that Diane's speech had been, and having 100 or so people clapping each time something, you know, similar was asserted about anti-federalism or the Confederacy or the tyranny that America faces today, it had an effect on me. And Annabel said, you know, she admitted to me today that it had an effect on her as well, so that when we listened to her during the taping of this interview, it didn't sound as unusual as it does now after it's been about a month since we filmed this, and we just decided to start sharing our North Carolina adventure videos now. There's something about we are social animals, and when you are surrounded by people who are all of the same mind, and I could really sense that the people in the audience understood that they were part of the theater of it. Diane, in her speech at one point, asked them all to raise their hands and take an oath. And while I was filming it, it didn't seem odd to me, but later when I looked at the tape, I'm like, my goodness, these people all are swearing to something, and they don't know what Diane's going to say. They're just repeating it without any forewarning of what they're about to swear to. But it also occurred to me they knew that our camera was there and other cameras were there. And so there's something about that sort of herd mentality, that's what Nietzsche would have called it. There's something about maybe peer pressure that makes things that seem implausible suddenly plausible, and things that seem radical seem to be mainstream. And I know that Diane and just about everybody we talked to that day hasn't really been exposed to a world outside of that narrative construct. So, I can understand why she's gotten to the point where she's saying the things that she's saying. So why don't I play the clip, and then I'll let Annabelle respond. You'll hear Annabelle a little bit in this clip.
So when is that? When was that kind of optimal time where there were clear parameters?
I mean, 60s were great for me, and that's, I mean, that was my childhood, but there were no... we could sleep at night with our windows and our doors open in my community, and I was an ethnic community. I was not... It was Polish, Italian, Spanish, Irish, totally ethnic, and we were next to a town that was all Hispanic, okay? So it was very ethnic, but there was a time when we could sleep at night with our car doors open, our windows open, our house, our doors open. No violence, ever. You can go to school, and no one got pregnant. There was respect. There's respect for society, respect for one another.
So
in
what,
a healthy way.
So what is the turning point? Like what?
I don't know what the turning point is. That's a good question. I think everybody's thinking that they're more important than they are. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because everybody is special and created specially. But everybody wants something, you know, for themselves. You know, I deserve this because it's my right. Well, no. I mean, your rights are specifically recognized in the Bill of Rights. And don't look for more. You know what I mean? I think we're just getting too... We're personalizing certain groups. Why are we making what's uncommon about us so important? And that's... I don't know when that happened. Now, I'm watching the Democratic National Convention. Oh, we have Arab Democrats. We have Black Arab Democrats. We have Spanish, you know, Democrats. Every group. You know, and then you look at the Republicans. They're just... Republicans, they're all one, just one, you know. So I don't know when that happened.
Well, see, some people would say that the Republican Party was, again, predominantly white, you know.
But the whites fought for the blacks. That's the thing that
they
don't understand. It's the white Republicans, the conservatives, fought so hard for the end of slavery, for the civil rights, fought to integrate the schools. The whole history is replete with that. It's so complete, and it's consistent, and they've turned their back, and they'll tell you, at some point, you know, the Republicans just don't represent blacks anymore. And, well, I don't know when that happened, because everything they have was from Republican senators, congressmen. And it's kind of a slap in the face, but I think one thing they talked about during the election is, you guys want to take entitlements away from us. No, we don't. No one will ever take... We're charitable people. There'll always be programs to help. We just don't want it generally.
So there were two things in there that I just want to point out before we bring Annabelle on. One is that the Newt Gingrich line that the election was actually about food stamps, and that President Obama was the food stamp president, and the sort of racial undertones of that were not lost on Diane. She sort of understood the conversation between the Tea Party and African Americans, or the Republican Party and African Americans, to have something to do with handouts and the taking away or not taking away of handouts. And of course, I think most people know that the majority of Americans who are on food stamps are white, not people of color. The majority of people in the United States who are in poverty are white, not people of color. And then the other piece to that is that she is, at the same time, she's using the rhetoric of the Confederacy to sort of, I don't know exactly what she's trying to do, but she's trying to build rapport with her audience, or maybe she truly believes that Lincoln was wrong to try to end slavery through the Civil War, or preserving the Union through Civil War. And it's a very popular sentiment in the South. It's probably, I don't know, I might say it's the majority of opinion, at least among whites in the South. But she at the same time says that Republicans, and I guess implicitly white Republicans, deserve credit for ending slavery. So there are some people who pointed out that inconsistency on the Facebook page. Annabelle, you really did an amazing job talking to Diane and sort of getting her to pinpoint that moment in time when it was not our country anymore, so that she could better clarify how we were to get back to that country that she was missing. What's your thought on it now that's sort of become a bit of a sensation through our Facebook page?
I think at the time, like, what really struck me more than anything was that, you know, when I asked her about the Southern strategy, because she kept saying, you know, how come all African Americans are Democrats? And I think she wanted to talk about the fact that Democratic Party was offering entitlements or more or less, you know, bribery. but when I, you know, I asked her, well, what about the Southern strategy? Don't you think that explains why African Americans would be turned off to, you know, the Republican Party? Like, she actually didn't know what it was. And then when I tried to explain basically what the Southern strategy was, that this was an electoral strategy to basically flip the South, which had been Democratic, into Republican Party in the 60s with Nixon. I mean, she it just seemed like she didn't know any of that. So that was the thing that I took away at the time, that, wow, that was really odd that she is really into history, because I had read some of her stuff on her blog before I talked to her. And she seemed actually very a lover of history, that she didn't seem to know anything about that kind of more or less recent history of the Republican Party. But, I mean, you know, now that we looked at the entire interview and we had to make editing choices for this video, you know, I realized that there is a very strong narrative that she's trying to advance that really doesn't fit with, like, how I understand American history and American politics. But I still, it's still kind of familiar to me because I grew up in the South. I actually moved from Korea to Houston, you know, when I was 9, and more or less got my education in Texas and had that kind of more or less Southern take on the Civil War. So it was familiar to me, but it was something that I have kind of really distanced myself from, that way of understanding the Civil War and history. So when she was making, not only presenting it, but really trying to use it to organize the Tea Party and this movement, I guess, and that's what I guess more or less I've been trying to process is, okay, how does that fit with, like, with the rest of America, and how does it fit with contemporary politics? It's just, there's such a disconnect, and I would love to spend more time with her and just kind of explore more of what I think is, like, a disconnect, and I'm sure she feels like I'm disconnected.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did invite her to be on the show with us. We're going to try again on another day. She might be too busy because she does wear a lot of hats, and she's a mom. I think she said she had 4 kids. Michael, did you have a comment before we bring on our first caller? I know who it is. It's going to be Nicole Marin, whose blog about this video is in the chat room, and it's also referenced in the homepage at coffeepartyusa.com. But Michael, did you have a comment?
Yes, I did. You know, I perhaps as a Republican and as a moderate slash conservative, you know, I hear things perhaps a little differently, or perhaps certain phrases, certain topics are foregrounded for me that might not be for other people. One of the things that I found most interesting was her adherence to the idea that that the Republican Party was homogenous in thinking. I'm not talking about race now, and whether it's a lot of old white men, of which, frankly, I'm afraid I'm starting to be one. But but the idea that, you know, she pointed out that there's, you know, there's an Arab Democratic Caucus, there's a Black Democratic Caucus, whatever, and but in they're just Republicans. But we know, and I wonder whether you had a chance to talk to her about this, Annabelle, or whether she was somehow insulated from the very obvious and very public now internecine warfare that's going on. I realize at the time you did this interview, Karl Rove hadn't yet come out and said, I'm going after the Tea Party, essentially.
Right.
But it's very clear. I mean, I'm a moderate Republican, and I'm very, very far away from the stereotype of what the Tea Party has become. And there's a large, certainly there's a Black Republican caucus and there's a Latino Republican caucus, there's a Women's Republican caucus. The same kinds of groups exist. Mm-hmm. Was she not in any way, did you have a chance to talk with her about that? Was she not in any way acknowledging of the differences within the Republican Party?
No, actually, I didn't follow up on that. I should have. But I guess I was a bit surprised that she was saying that. And then when I, you know, did follow up with her and say, well, you know, people said that's because the Republican Party is predominantly white, then she kind of immediately went off into a tangent about, but, you know, basically white Republican saved African American narrative, which I found kind of shocking. So I didn't follow up, but I would love to follow up on that. And
well, and the related question, of course, is the idea that the Republican Party is fundamentally and philosophically the same thing that it always has been, when clearly there's been a big shift, you know, from the late Eisenhower days when they began to plan the Southern strategy. It would be interesting to see whether or not that's a set of a lens through which Tea Party believers such as Diane do not look through or do not see.
Yeah, well, she clearly didn't know about the Southern strategy, which I don't quite understand, but she didn't. She wasn't faking it. She really didn't know. But I guess there's so many things I do want to follow up with her about. But I do want to stress that I felt like she wanted to have a conversation. I don't know if it comes across in the video, but I guess I felt kind of grateful that she wanted to talk to me and that I felt like she was trying to engage.
I agree. I got that same sense. I didn't feel there was any disingenuousness. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, I'm going to take a moment to pat you on the back. You have a sort of a calming and disarming. You have a way of making these interviews a safe space for people. And I think you get people to say things and talk about things that they wouldn't ordinarily do without, and you do it without rising any ire. So it's always interesting watching these Story of America pieces. We have, Eric, as you mentioned, we have Nicole waiting. We also have a queue of callers interested. I just want to give out the phone number very quickly before you give to before you go to Nicole. If you'd like to join us and talk about, you know, very specifically, we want to stay on topic tonight about where can we find some common ground with Tea Party. And again, I think Tea Party now has become a more amorphous phrase than it has been as the thinking about it spreads a little bit. The number is 646-929-2495. We do have a number of people in queue. We will start getting to you very quickly. If you're interested in joining, we'll get to as many of you as we can. Please press 1 on your phone after you've called in, and it will put you in queue. Eric, I'm going to turn this back over to you to bring Nicole on.
Sure. Well, Nicole Marin, who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, wrote a response on the Coffee Party Facebook page, facebook.com/coffeeparty, that really got Annabelle excited. She says, "This is exactly the kind of dialogue that I was hoping that Story of America and, of course, Coffee Party before it would engender." And I was there. I witnessed it when Annabelle got Nicole on the phone, and then I grabbed the phone and I said, "Hey, would you come on our show today?" So, Nicole, you're going to be on now with Annabelle. You guys can talk for the second time in the history of the Earth. Tell us about your take on welcome to the show, first of all, and tell us about your take on the video that we did.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here, and I was thrilled to be invited. I think you've started a wonderful conversation, and I'm stoked to be a part of it. So I came across the video, you know, via Facebook, as we do. And I feel like I should preface this by saying I've been in a lot of conversations with a lot of people on Facebook, and I feel like trying to find that middle ground, trying to find some place of commonality is something that I am coming to the hard way. I've spent a lot of time being angry in forums. I do live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am definitely a liberal. I'm in very much a liberal bubble where I live. My family is all Democratic, and I don't really get a lot of personal one-on-one contact with people who think, you know, very differently. You know, there's lots of nuance, but you know, we have some fundamental progressive values that are definitely kind of I'm constantly surrounded with and never seem to be in question. So when I get into a conversation like the one we had and listening to points made, like this Tea Party leader, I'm finding that I feel like I'm hearing the same things over and over again. So part of me has stepped back just to really look at how we're talking. And there's lots of opportunity for improvement there. One of my biggest takeaways, as I wrote in my blog response from this, was that, you know, this woman is sincere. You know, I don't agree with just about anything she said. But she is, very clearly, emotionally attached to what she's saying, whether she understands it or not. And the immediate reaction from most people, you know, on the left, when the Tea Party comes out with statements like white Republicans are the savior of people of color, elicit incredibly strong emotional reactions, and perhaps rightfully so. But the way those get expressed is that everybody immediately goes for the personal. And it's very much a catch-22 and a double-edged sword, if I can mix my metaphors, because there is definitely a strain in all of the conversations I've had with Tea Party folk that I have contact with via forums like Facebook or other comments sections or other online conversations, where any criticism is really taken as a personal attack and a deeply personalized one. And we get stuck in, to some extent, the trap that a very well-known video blogger and social commentator, Dave Smooth, describes wonderfully in his video, How Do You Tell Someone They Sound Racist, that you want to have the, what are they saying conversation, not the who they are conversation. You know, what is it that they did that we can point to as something that we can talk about and that we can criticize, versus taking that to, and therefore you are whatever. You know, you are a sinner, you are a racist, you are a instead of the other. And he makes the wonderful point that when we do that, what happens is that we, in a weird way, we let them off the hook for actually being responsible for what they're saying, because they can simply say, I'm not a racist, I've never been a racist, what are you talking about? And it becomes this completely indefensible and very, very circular argument about, well, you are, you aren't, versus, you know, this was said and this is the effect that it had on me. So, I wanted to make the point that when we talk about searching for common ground, we can't do that when we're talking about something that we fundamentally disagree on. We're never going to find common ground on, one very radical church's interpretation of the Bible and how it says that gay people are not natural versus, people who don't have that experience and think that, being gay is simply another part of the human condition that shouldn't really be in question and certainly shouldn't be penalized in any sort of legal or social way. So, those things are never going to get us to any point of commonality. But I do believe that there is enough overlap. If we can find those things, we can get to the humanity in each other. And the overlap can be specifically with the Tea Party. There's a lot of overlap with the Tea Party and progressive communities that say, corruption in government is a little out of control, and that our Congress is bought and sold. And there's a lot of truth to that. We have different opinions about who is being bought and sold. And I don't mean to say that there is parity from both sides, because I do think that the ongoing criticism of the left for people in Urfina's position are that, they're not articulate, they're not adhering to history, they're presenting facts that are not facts. They are.
Right. Nicole, let me just interrupt you for a second. I want to ask Annabelle a question. Annabelle, what was it that got you singing when you read Nicole's blog? And I think specifically what I want to know is where is that common ground specifically that you think, I know you've spoken with Reverend Barber at length, who in many ways Diane Rufino was responding to. A fellow North Carolinian, but very much on the other end of the political spectrum, Reverend Dr. William Barber. But you talked to Reverend Barber about there being common ground as well, and he agrees. So can you pinpoint that to, for us before we start kicking some of our other callers?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I love the fact that, you know, Nicole started talking about what she was just talking about, the corruption, how we can create this alliance with the Tea Party and or supporters of the Tea Party on the fact that, you know, we really need to do something about the, you know, influence of, you know, money in our politics. And that is something that I would love to talk to Tea Party about. And I have talked to some Tea Party people about this. Is, you know, what I remember about the Tea Party's origin was that there were a lot of people upset about the bank bailout. And I was upset about the bank bailout as well in 2008. And so I keep thinking, like, well, can we get back to that discussion? Because there are a lot of people still upset about the fact that, you know, Wall Street got away with murder, and that we still haven't fixed Wall Street. We don't have accountability. We don't trust Wall Street, and therefore we don't trust government in some ways. And so, I mean, there's so much common ground there. And I, you know, I had this Venn diagram that I also shared, and that you put in the email blast, you know, which basically says, you know, we're using kind of slightly different language, and we're focusing, the Tea Party is focusing on the government being the problem, and the progressives focus more on the corporations being a problem. But it really, there really is a collusion of the two, corporations and government, that is creating this corruption to the point where most people don't feel like they are getting representation. So it is a we the people problem. And that is something that I think can unite majority of Americans, who poll after poll, you know, shows that, you know, Americans are very deeply upset about the role of big money in our government. And so there is common ground. And I would love to have a conversation with people in the middle, people who identify with the Tea Party, whatever, say, can we just focus our attention on this?
Okay. Well, we have quite a few callers. Nicole, stick around. We're going to see if there's a way we can bring you back into the conversation. Let's go to Cameron. He is a member of the Coffee Party Board of Directors. He said he wanted to get a comment in before he had to run to another meeting. Cameron, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Annabelle, great to hear your voice for sure. And especially after watching that video, you are incredibly, incredibly inviting when it comes to interviews. And Nicole is reading what your response was, and so eloquent. What I really want to say, and Annabelle, you gave me a really great segue for this, is that I think on many levels, the left and the right paradigm that we have in our political discourse is kind of leading to the same point that I think we all have, and that is to get money out of politics. The whole nine yards behind all of these derivative issues that we have, and I started thinking about this more today because I think I sent out an email about this, is that the whole paradigm of united we stand, divided we fall is, I think, what we're really fighting here. And it stands very true today as it was back in the 1700s. If we can't get along in order to facilitate our own best interests, we're going to continue along these same lines of hating on one another and not really attacking the problems. And, you know, however people feel, I mean, I watched that video and I'm thinking to myself, man, there's so much ignorance in everything that she's saying. Lincoln forced South Carolina to fire the first shot, or that she would love to institute an environment where, you know, there was Christian prayer in school again, and that there was no violence ever. And a lot of these things are fairly much pipe dreams for people to have. And legislating morality is just such a hard thing for people to discuss. But I think on many levels, for us to have a civil society back to ourselves, we're going to have to really force the entry of having, you know, the Tea Party in this context and the left liberals in another context, getting together to try and fight the one thing that is, you know, majorly a bad part of our society, and that is having our government bought and paid for through campaign donations. On so many levels, it just makes some sense to see that. I guarantee if we went after people that have these thoughts, that they think that Lincoln forced South Carolina to fire the first shot. I guarantee if we ask them the questions, how do you feel about money in politics? A good percentage of them would be like, I think it's the most corrupt system on the planet. And that's where what everybody who are the people of the United States of America, I guarantee on many levels that they would all feel that way. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, I mean,
so
I think that there's divisions about exactly how to fix it, but the outrage that most people feel when the subject comes up is great, and I think it is kind of universal. Like, it is a problem that very few people actually would deny. So, but how do we get to that point where we can actually start organizing is the million-dollar question. How do we do that?
How do we open that conversation up? And that's the thing that's really been something I've been trying to rack my brain around. I don't know the full answer to that. I always love to have this conversation continuously.
Well, Cameron, stick around. We're going to bring in another caller, 404 area code. We're coming to 347-770-620 and 908. After that, 404, you're on the middle ground with Michael Charney, Eric Beiler, Annabel Park, Cameron Kruger and Nicole Marin. What's on your mind? Tell us where you're calling from, your name, where you're calling from, and then tell us what's on your mind. Sorry.
Robert Rodrigo in Atlanta. Good evening, everybody. Hope everybody is well.
Hey,
hey Robert.
I have a couple of things I want to. I watched the video. I've been driving for the last 4 hours, but I watched the video. I couldn't read the response. I was actually hoping it was what you guys described. But I have to tell you, I respectfully disagree with the common ground approach, and I'll tell you why. Not approach, I'm sorry. The common ground, that there is a common ground that you say. I spent a lot of time having discussions with members of the Tea Party, very civil, very, very intelligent discussions about issues that we have. I have a number of longtime neighborhood friends that I'm involved with this. Matter of fact, the majority of my discussions personally are with Tea Party or, I don't know, quote-unquote conservative-minded people. Though I don't even like saying it that way. It's really Tea Party people that I'm having discussions with. And when I watched that video, it reminded me of a couple of things that I want to point out. First of all, when it comes to the idea of money in politics, if you go and ask somebody in the Tea Party, in my experience, if you don't like money in politics, they'll say yes. But the difference is between what we discuss in the coffee party and the Tea Party approach. The Tea Party is all about the free market. So they are all about, at least in my experience with them, they are all about deregulation. Whereas in the coffee party, unless I'm wrong, the majority of our consensus seems to be that we need to get a handle on what happened to Wall Street. We want accountability. We want to remove them from it. And most of my experience with the Tea Party is that their government is too big because it's socialist. It wants to give away stuff for free, especially under the tenure of President Obama because of the other aspects of that. The other part that disturbs me greatly about the Tea Party and their presentation, and it was absolutely in this video, is how, and I've said this before about libertarians, is how they pick and choose which quote-unquote Bill of Rights that they actually do like. It's almost like, in my view, they'll jump right over the First Amendment, which has so many things, parts to it. Actually, it really has most parts of any amendment. And they go right to the Second Amendment, which they fully embrace in the standpoint of freedom, and we want all the guns in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whether you agree or disagree. And, you know, they rarely talk about the Fourth Amendment. They rarely talk about the Fifth Amendment. But when she mentions school prayer, the aspect of that disturbs me the most is that there are so many people in the Tea Party that I have talked to, as well as libertarians, that believe, I submit incorrectly, that this country is a Christian nation. I believe this country is a free nation. And even though we've had discussions in the past that the Bill of Rights and the Constitution was written by a bunch of elitists, a very finite group of people, white men, rich, etc., they really did a good job when it came to the balance with the three branches of the government checking each other and what the Bill of Rights actually says. Because when it comes right down to it, we're constantly bumping up against that, and the Bill of Rights is written for the one person. So when I hear so many Tea Party people talking about the Christian nation and using it as a way to supplant gains in equal rights, as Nicole mentioned, for example, the gay community, you know, et cetera, I believe that they don't understand the Constitution and what it really says, how it is for the one person. And the categories that we put people in, ethnic or social habits or whatever it might be, gay, black, red, white, blue, whatever, those things are what's creating the issue. If everybody was looked at as a member of the human race and we remove everything and look at the Bill of Rights that way, then you have everybody being equal and forget the titles. And our country is
actually
full of division. Like
Robert,
that.
I heard the same argument actually from some of the people at that rally, that the reason why race is an issue is that the government recognizes race. And in fact, another person, the man who organized the rally, Annabelle, maybe you can help me with his last name, his first name was Glenn, was
Bradley.
Saying that the problem, yeah. What was it, Annabelle?
Bradley, Glenn Black.
Ben Bradley. He had served in the state house up until actually the day before that rally, and then he had lost his election in the primary level to another Republican, a more establishment Republican. But he said the problem he had with Brown versus Board of Education was not that they made the wrong decision, but they made it for the wrong reason, and that the real reason should have been recognizing individual rights, not recognizing the rights of racial groups. And then by starting down the path of recognizing the rights of racial groups, it created the division we see in America today. Annabelle, I know you probably want to respond to the idea that there isn't much hope for common ground, but let me take another call first, and then you can respond to both of them. 347 area code, you are on the middle ground. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind. Are you there, 347? You might be have your phone muted, maybe?
Hello?
Hello, we got you.
You got me now?
Yep.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'll tell you quite frankly, what really ticked me off about looking at that interview, I'm a veteran. I also happen to be African-American. And I also happen to be a registered Democrat. I have attended quite a few coffee party meetings. I find the coffee party, they're good folks. Could do a lot of work with them. But looking at this possible linkage or joining together or whatever with the Tea Party, especially in their present state, I would have to say that that is really out, an idea that's out to lunch. These people, quite frankly, they're a large part of the problem that we face in 21st century America. They claim that they're exercised by big government. And I want to know, when Bush Jr. was, you know, dragging us into an unnecessary war, spending big money, not to mention spending big lives, you know, where were they? I don't understand. I never heard of the Tea Party until Barack Obama essentially got in the mix. And don't think for a minute, even though I volunteered in this campaign, you know, he's not a saint. He's not God. And I have a lot of bones to pick with him. But all in all, as presidents go, he's certainly not one of the worst. And in his own kind of, you know, clumsy way, he has tried to do some good. This thing about the Tea Party, it to me, it sounds like they want to fight FDR and the New Deal. They want to fight Johnson's war on poverty. They want to fight the Civil Rights Bill. You know, they want to fight women's right to choice. You know, this is the track that these folks are always on. Mm-hmm. So how can the progressive people you know, sit down at the table with these fools. I don't understand it. I don't think Lincoln was a dictator. He did what he did because of war powers. He didn't start the darn war. Slavery did that. They need to go to school. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to take up too much time. I just want to get that off my chest. I'm sorry.
No.
Is that you, Robert?
Yeah.
Okay, I got an email from you, and I said, and you had a similar sentiment, and I said, please call in and share that. That was actually, I'm impressed with the breadth of your historical knowledge, and it's a lot more familiar to me, at least, than what we heard from Diane from the Tea Party. But Annabelle, what do you think?
Yeah.
You've had two calls in a row now, both from actually people of color, and you're a person of color.
I am too. Uh-huh.
Okay, and I'm half of one. Can we find any common ground with these, I don't want to say fools, but that's what Robert just said. Can we find common ground with the Tea Party?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the question I have. First of all, I think we should, for the purpose of kind of the next part of this conversation, I want to drop the Tea Party. Let's just say there are people we vehemently disagree with in terms of our values and reading of history and constitution, whatever. There are people we disagree with in this country. So this is where I'm coming from. Okay, I grew up in South Korea where, there was a civil war in the 20th century, 60 years ago, and over a million people died, okay? We slaughtered each other because we had different views about what kind of government we should have. And people got slaughtered, and the country is still divided. There hasn't been a peace treaty, so we're still technically, U.S. and South Korea, we're still technically at war with North Korea, okay? So coming from that, and even though I was born in 68, my childhood felt like I was in a poor country. I mean, there was scarcity of food, and it was there was always a threat of war. I grew up with drills and, basically being made to be afraid that there could be an invasion any day, okay? So, I feel like when I see how polarized we become and how uncompromising we become, I wonder, where is this going? Okay, how far are people willing to go to say, I don't want to have anything to do with these people, okay? Because to me, if we don't find a way to see each other as fellow Americans, we're on a path to war of some kind, okay? Whether it's secession or real war or domestic terrorism, it would get ugly and violent eventually because we feel so divided, alienated and hateful, okay? And then I think about people we admire. Why did Obama become a national figure? Well, he made this brilliant speech in 2004 that laid out a vision for America, a story of America, where he proclaimed that there is no blue America or red America. We have the United States of America. He's talking about having unity. And think about Civil War. And Lincoln and all the people who tried to keep the Union together, sacrificing so much to just to keep the Union together, and all the people who after the war participated genuinely in Reconstruction to have some reconciliation so we can be one country. People sacrificed a lot for us to have a United States of America, to have a Union, okay? And for us right now to say, okay, well, we disagree with them about this, about Social Security, about prayer in school, about gay rights, and therefore I don't want to have anything to do with those people and basically be willing to throw away all that sacrifice and all that work, that went into keeping the Union together. I can't go with that. We have to find a way to see each other as fellow Americans, not see each other as enemies because we disagree. And the reason why, to me, the corruption issue is different from prayer in school or some of these other issues that divide us is that, we have to have basic ground rules
of engagement in our democracy. And if that, though, if those ground rules don't work, then, you know, it's impossible for us to feel like we have any form of self-governance. Because it's okay if we disagree. We're supposed to disagree. We're supposed to have a diverse country in which people bring their experiences and opinions, and that's a good thing. And democracy is supposed to be that process that helps us coexist and make decisions together, despite the fact that we disagree.
Okay.
And so that's why democracy is so important. That's why I'm not going to give up on preserving the union.
Annabelle, let me ask Robert if he wants to respond real quickly, and then we have a lot of more calls to get to. Robert, what did you think of Annabelle's plea for unity?
Can you hear me?
We do.
Oh, okay. You know, what Annabelle just said, I have to admit that she has a very valid point. And I spent, like I told you, I'm a veteran. I spent a lot of time with people from areas where the Tea Party is, really, how shall I say, a big thing. And I spent a lot of time with people like that. And, oddly enough, I agree with Annabelle. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. I admit that. And I tell you, frankly, I'll just say this a little bit, give up and give other people a chance. I am very, very afraid right now. If I had the magic lamp with the genie, my first wish would be for, $10 million. My second wish would be to move to Sweden or Norway or something of that, somewhere in those countries. Because I tell you, quite frankly, I, like Annabelle, I'm very afraid of what the future portends. And what you got to understand, these are the people right now, unfortunately, they are in the minority, but they are calling a lot of the shots. Because the Republicans in the House will not do a thing, all right, because they're scared of being what's the new term we have? Primaried by people that think like the people that Annabelle was interviewing. And their basic purpose is not to elect people to send them to Washington to do things. Their basic inclination is to vote for people to come to Washington to tear it down. And that is so dangerous. Especially in the 21st century, it is very dangerous. But no, I'm not knocking Annabelle. She's trying to do something positive, and that's a good thing. What will happen? I don't know. Listen, thank you very much for the time.
Robert, thank you, and thank you for your service to our country.
Bye now.
Okay, we're going to go to 620 area code. I can't wait to hear what Michael Charney is going to say when we come back to him. 620 area code. You're on the air with
okay.
Michael Charney, Eric Byler.
Jack Golding. This is Jack Golding. I'd like to agree with Annabelle, but from what I hear, the Tea Party types, and I'd say the whole damn Republican Party from Boehner down to Cantor and even the more so-called moderates. They're out to do two things. They're out to destroy government as we know it. And their attitude is my way or the highway. And we can't tolerate that. I mean, I just can't tolerate an attitude like that. And they're going to be uncompromising. And much as I would like to hope that Annabelle refuses to prevail, I can't crooked. Okay.
Well, Jack, were you saying that the moderate Republicans are also
I don't think there are any moderates left.
Well, here's one, Michael Charney. Michael Charney.
Hi there. I'm the moderate Republican.
Yeah, but there's none in Congress.
Very few.
Even
there are a few.
What's their name? Two sisters from Maine, I like to call them. One of them is gone.
Olympia Snow and Susan Collins.
Susan Collins, two sisters from Maine. But they're even intimidated. Olympia Snow gave it up.
She did.
As I said, there are, McConnell, I think a good thing happening would be Ashley Judd. I think they're afraid of him. Afraid of her. The good thing would be for Ashley Judd to come in and beat Mitch McConnell.
Okay, can I respond to that, Chuck?
Sure, Annabelle, go ahead. I'm sorry. Jack. I was about to speak, so I'll take myself off, and you go ahead, Annabelle.
Oh, no, go ahead, Michael. Go ahead, Michael. You go ahead.
Well, I agree with you, Jack, in that there are fewer active there are fewer Republicans behaving as moderates in Congress. I do believe that there are more moderates in Congress if the Republican Party can sort of muddle its way through, maybe that's the wrong word, fight its way through the internal struggles that they're having. If you look historically, and we define moderate a bit differently, you know, John Boehner is not a Tea Party guy. I mean, he's I don't know that I'd go so far as to say he's a moderate guy, but he's a moderate conservative historically. And people like John Boehner, a Congress filled with people like John Boehner who aren't being held hostage from within their own party and are worried about, to use the word primary, worried about being primaried, worried about, as he was, possibly even losing the speakership, it takes backbone and courage from the John Boehners that are there to get the party back on track. The party is never going to be the Democratic Party, and I think that there's this, you know, sometimes I hear this sort of underlying current that, that until the Republicans think like moderate Democrats, then that's not a good thing. I would disagree with that. We need moderate and conservative Republicans as a balance, and we always have had a need for the balance between the parties. And I think we're starting to see. We saw in the last election, and I hope it continues into 2014. If we see a continued weakening of the what I'm now calling the stereotypical Tea Party representatives, you know, the kind of people that a Christine O'Donnell represents, or Sharon Engel, the two who lost their Senate races. If we continue to see that weakening, I think you will see the Republican Party more willing to compromise. You're never going to see a change in the rhetoric. They're always going to be at each other's throats on TV because that's what they do and that's what they've always done. But I do think you'll see a moderation, and I think you'll see more moderate Republicans come out of the woodwork, more moderate Republicans starting to go and vote in the primaries in order to keep their party whole. I'm very optimistic that the pendulum will swing back.
Annabelle, quickly, because we have a 908 area code that's been on hold for 55 minutes. They're about to set a record.
Okay, really quickly. There is a very, very simple fix to marginalizing the real extremists, the real uncompromising people in Congress on both sides, which is simply to increase voter turnout during primaries. So if you had more people, period, turn out to vote in the primaries, then we're going to have different politics. So it's not, you know, rocket science. We just have to work on that turnout with more so-called moderate people, but just more Americans voting would solve this problem overnight. Okay,
I couldn't agree with you more, Annabelle. You are right on it. It is simple. It's not easy, unfortunately, because we know that the more emotionally driven people are the ones who tend to come out for the primaries. If we can find a way to motivate the middle to come out in the primaries, absolutely things will change. People like the, you know, the Huntsmans and the Pawlentys of the world would have a fighting chance if those people came out in the primaries, no question.
Well, we're going to make that a goal with this radio show and with the Coffee Party Network, to find those moderate Republicans, to pep them up and give them some support, and let them know that it is their civic duty to vote not only in the general election but also in the primaries. And with that, 908 area code, 56 minutes and 45 seconds. I think that is a Coffee Party radio record. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
Yeah, John from New Jersey. Sorry I have a cold, but I will get through it. I think, Michael, you say you're a moderate Republican, correct?
The word I use is actually considerable, but moderate.
Do you side Tea Party or not?
I'm sorry?
Do you side with Tea Party views?
No, actually, for the most part, I stress sort of the stereotypical Tea Party views. The Tea Party here in New Hampshire is a little different. No, I don't. And as a matter of fact, I'm on record in, you know, essay after essay and two books on what I think the Tea Party has done to hurt American politics. And I'm on record as saying I think they are the fundamental problem with American politics today.
Okay. But you're concerned with government waste, correct?
Yes. Okay. So, and I am concerned with government waste. I am concerned with taxes. I just want to make the distinction between the stereotypical Tea Party and I think what I believe were and for many in the Tea Party still are the core and overriding principles, which is to eliminate all the social issues, but to talk about smaller government, smarter government. Not necessarily lower taxes, but smarter taxes, much less government spending, a fair bit of less government oversight, particularly in personal lives. It's closer to a libertarian view than a Tea Party view,
How about government spending as far as military spending? What about an old issue, $2.3 trillion, which Donald Rumsfeld admitted years ago that was unaccounted for? They had hearings about this, and then of course even after 9/11, there was admitted, by Donald Rumsfeld and others about this $2.3 trillion in the DOD, Department of Defense. So you know it's all the time from the Republican side and the Tea Party side that it's all social program waste, right? But what about the Department of Defense waste that was admitted to just prior to 9/11?
Well, I don't know about the $2.3 trillion. I read recently a $90 billion figure. I know there's a push to audit the Department of Defense. I would support that completely. There's a tremendous amount of waste there. I don't agree that the Tea Party is focused only on social issue and domestic, domestic and quote unquote entitlement spending as a way to cut.
There was $2.3 trillion over multiple years, and Senator Byrd and others were a part of that hearing, and then years went on, and of course, you know, Rumsfeld said that we're going to try and do something about it. Nothing was done. 9/11 occurs. A little bit more talk about doing something about it. You know, then later, you know, we have a Tea Party movement. But nothing in regards to $2.3 trillion missing in the Party.
So let me just ask, I want to make sure I understand your point. Are you suggesting that the Tea Party ignores those things in
Absolutely.
Favor of the social issues?
Absolutely, or ignores military waste. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't – certainly my experience with the local Tea Party, which is limited, would suggest that that's not the case. But again, that's limited, and I admit that New Hampshire has a very libertarian spirit, and is much less concerned with social issues in general. So I don't know that the Tea Party up here is quite fits the stereotype. And
if you don't think
the Tea Party people I've spoken with are very much in favor of auditing the Fed. They're very much in favor of reducing military spending. Many of them are interested in smarter military spending.
And if you don't think that $2.3 trillion is true and accurate, go in regards to 60 Minutes and CBS News.
No, I'm not debating you on the number. I'm just saying I've not heard it before. I'm not suggesting that it's not true. And there's more than one episode on record of money disappearing in the Pentagon.
What do you feel as a Republican that should be done in regards to investigations and about current within the military?
As far as investigations, I don't know the vagaries and the ins and outs of how they put together investigations on Capitol Hill, and I don't want to speak to what should or shouldn't be done on that level. I will tell you, as a Republican and personally, I feel that defense spending needs to be two things need to happen in the Pentagon from my point of view. I believe defense spending needs to be reduced very, very carefully and very, very slowly. I do think we overspend. I do think that in an attempt to reduce the debt and the deficit, and by the way, I'm much more concerned about the debt than I am about the deficit, but in an effort to reduce them, I think the Pentagon is absolutely a place to start. It's bloated. Money gets lost. Money is being spent on things that the military doesn't even want. The Joint Chiefs don't even want. On the other hand, if you cut those programs, you will put tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of civilians out of work. The military-industrial complex cannot afford that kind of a shock. So it needs to be done very slowly, very conservatively, if you will. At the same time, I think the Department of Defense, as a Republican, needs to look at more intelligent ways to spend the money, things like cyber wars, for example, those kinds of a much more modern approach to defense than it takes. I don't think the military is equipped to fight the kinds of 21st century battles that could exist without humans and in bits and bytes. But very slow and very carefully, because the economic impact of dramatic change would be horrendous in my mind.
Thank you for those questions, John. We have 270-724 and 908 area codes to get to next. And just as a response, I remember that, and I will post the video, stay tuned to Story of America, video series, that one speaker in particular at this rally, which was not officially a Tea Party rally, but it certainly had a lot of the characteristics, spoke against the Iraq War and even against the Afghanistan War and about bringing troops home and spending less on the military, and he got a lot of support from the audience there, and actually no one gave him any lip. So 270 area code, you're on the middle ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler, special guest Annabelle Park. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
270?
Yeah, it's you.
Okay, hello. I'm Paul Estep, and I'm calling from Owensboro, and I'm a Tea Party member here with a local Tea Party. And I attend the coffee party meetings occasionally for the Owensboro Coffee Party, and I have found common ground on some issues with them. I regularly go there, and one of the reasons why I go there is to ask for their support for certain bills in the Kentucky legislature.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is they're trying to pass a bill to allow officers to take DNA at arrest. And we oppose that, and I know the Coffee Party people oppose that too. We support the restoring of felon voting rights, which I know that many of the Coffee Party people would support. The hemp bill is another one where we both support. So I think there is common ground, but you have to talk about the issues that we can both agree on and leave the other stuff we disagree on outside of the conversation. Because I sit in Coffee Party meetings, and if I allowed myself to talk and to converse, I'd be arguing with the group all the time. It'd be the focus of attention. But what I try to do is just go there and listen, and occasionally I'll speak up or if they ask me an opinion, but I go there to get their support for things I know that we can agree on.
So you don't go in and argue about the causes of the Civil War?
Pardon?
So you're from Kentucky. It was Paul, right?
Yes.
You don't go into a coffee party meeting and argue with people about the causes of the Civil War?
No, I don't. I try my, you know, it depends on my mood. But I try my best just to get there and listen, to ask for their support on things I know that both of us can support.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the problem is that so many people are trying to look at the differences between the two movements and not the common ground.
I bet you Annabelle would like to talk with you. I'm going to bring her back in. Annabelle, do you want to respond to Paul from Kentucky?
Hey, Paul, I've heard about you. I'm glad
we also had another chat once before.
Oh, hey. Well, this is great. I'm really glad you called in because, you know, I sometimes feel like a broken record because I do talk a lot about the need for having dialogue and the need for listening. And so, you know, it's music to my ears when you say that you know, that you go there with a certain frame of mind, that you're not there to agree with people on everything, convince people of everything, but you like to listen and you chime in when you know that there's something to be gained there. So I really appreciate what you have to say. I just wanted to point out that it's important that we approach these conversations with the desire and intention to understand one another. I think when we are approaching this conversation, even just in the radio show, I felt like, you know, like John, the last caller, like from the get-go, I felt a sense that he had a bone to pick, and it didn't seem like a dialogue in which people were invited to share their views. I mean, of course, Michael was a gentleman, but I guess that's the kind of thing I would like to encourage is, you know, we can talk about the content of what we're saying, you know, where we disagree, but I also think we need to talk about and think about the form, how we're approaching this. And so, when I do the interviews, often I'm disagreeing with what the person's saying, but I do try to listen. And I think that comes across in the interview. And what's great to me about America is that you're allowed to disagree. You're allowed to have differences of opinion. And I feel like sometimes we've forgotten that, you know, First Amendment is our First Amendment, and that free speech is something that we should all value, and that we should give each other room to share our point of view. And so, I do want to really emphasize that in this conversation is that it's okay and it's good for us to disagree. It's more important that we're talking to each other. If we don't talk to each other and say, you're so different from me, you're not even worth talking to, that's when I get worried, not when someone disagrees with me about something.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. And thank you for attending the meetings and for calling in.
No problem. I've always respected a lot of what you said and thought a lot of it rings true. I disagree with some of your politics, but I always thought you treated the Tea Party fairly. So,
what about this issue about corruption? Is that something where we can work together? I mean, I don't know if you saw that Venn diagram.
No, I haven't seen the video or anything. As far as corruption, I think it's the point is, I think the Tea Party works for it by trying to elect people they feel comfortable with, they feel are not corrupt. And I think part of the problem is the fact that, and I emphasize this at some of our at the coffee party meetings, that we need to de-evolve power up in the federal government and push it down to the state. Because at the state level, we have citizen activists that are up there lobbying our state officials on this legislation. That's why I know a lot about it, is because they come back and say, hey, this is a bill that's going through the legislature. We need to stop it. So there's a lot more power for the individual at the state level. And I think part of the problem with corruption is these people up in Washington are so far away from us that it really is very hard to keep track of them. That if we move that power back to the state, we could do a lot better job with corruption and stopping it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul from Kentucky. We actually have four more people we want to try to get to before the end of our show. 724-908-412 and 770. We're going to get to all of you. 724, you're on the middle ground. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hi, this is Greg from Pittsburgh. And I just wanted to say that I was really encouraged to hear that in a conversation that occurred, I guess, between, and I'm not sure, I was a little bit late joining, so I wasn't sure where the conversation took place, but it was, I was really encouraged to hear that representatives from the Tea Party were as concerned about money in politics and even the reinstitution of Glass-Steagall. I really was kind of stunned to hear that, but happy to hear that. And, you know, I'm kind of hopeful that, you know, maybe some at some point the Tea Party and the Coffee Party can work together on both of those issues, because to me those are the two that are probably at the core of a lot of our problems. And to the point of the diagram in the email, I mean, that is kind of at the heart of a lot of our issues. And so I wanted to say I was encouraged and I was heartened to hear that, and a little surprised, frankly. So.
Hi, Greg. This is Michael.
Hey, Michael.
That was at the top of the show. I was a little surprised, too, when I read the article from the Living Room Conversations. I just put the link to it in the chat room.
Oh, great.
So if you want to go sort of read the whole thing. There's not a lot of detail there. I imagine you can dig down and find some more information. But, yeah, I was a little surprised by that particular bullet point as well,
and
heartened to see it.
Yeah, I'm really pleasantly surprised to hear that. That's it doesn't sound characteristic, and I have to admit that, you know, I don't have a lot of exposure to individuals in the Tea Party. I've been to one Tea Party rally a few years ago. I had to see for myself what it was like, and it wasn't something that really had any kind of appeal to me at all. I won't belabor the point because there's only 15 minutes left of the show. But I just want to say this has been a great conversation, a great show. And if there's a way for the Coffee Party and the Tea Party to collaborate on those two issues, let's get to that middle ground and start working hard on that idea. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just realized, Eric, you had my mic open. I thought your mic was open. Thanks for calling in, Greg, by the way. We do have a couple more callers to get to. The question came up, I think, for those who aren't familiar with, and I'm no expert on Glass-Steagall, essentially it's from the 1930s. Glass and Steagall were the two politicians, a senator and a representative, who put it in, and it fundamentally created some separations within the banking community. So it limited some of the activities that commercial banks could do. It separated securities activities. It broke down the affiliations between commercial banks and securities firms. It essentially created walls between the different parts of the banking community in order to essentially, you know, limit the abilities of banks to do things. I'm not being terribly articulate, as I said. I'm not an expert on this. But basically, commercial banks could do things that securities firms could not do, that corporate banks could not do. And the advantages were that you wouldn't have these first of all, you wouldn't have certain kinds of banks being able to buy other kinds of banks because they weren't allowed to combine their businesses. So you were immune, not totally immune, but somewhat immune from these humongous sort of too big to fail banks. Secondly, Glass-Steagall sort of prevented inherent conflicts of interest. The kinds of risk taking that goes on with the security side of the business couldn't happen in the same institution that you and I were, you know, making our checking deposits in every day.
Yeah.
And so there was a fair bit of insulation. If one part of the financial community was in some sort of crisis, you wouldn't have the domino effects that we saw in the recent financial crisis. Glass-Steagall was repealed in 99, I guess. So really under Clinton. is when it took his death. So, again, I'm not an expert in the banking community. I'm admittedly, full disclosure, I'm on Wikipedia right now getting a few of these facts for people who are curious about it. Not my area of expertise, but I think the protections in Glass-Steagall, the lack of the protections when Glass-Steagall was repealed, there's general agreement in the economics and financial community that that was a significant contributing factor to the financial crisis, essentially the ability of the banks to play the kind of games they did.
Right. If they're taking our savings, they shouldn't be gambling it in a Wall Street casino, because then the same FDIC that protects our savings, in other words, the federal guarantee that protects our savings so the entire economy doesn't collapse when that casino doesn't pay out, well, now that federal guarantee has to be extended to all of their Ponzi schemes. And that's what we've got right now, and that's what collapsed our economy four and a half years ago. Okay, 908 area code. You're on the middle ground. Let us know your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind.
Hi, this is Chris in New Jersey.
Hey, Chris.
Hi. How are you? Yeah, so I'm calling in. But, I'm glad to hear this conversation. It's really important. Try to find the Tea Party, how the Tea Party and left liberals can try to work together on common ground. I think the really big thing, the main issue though, is the economic side of it. I think people are feeling like as far as the social issues that we have differences from each other, it's still a matter of people being uncomfortable in their economic situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what's bringing out a lot of these issues, you know, why people are clinging to their guns and, you know, why other people want those guns to be, you know, taken away from them, some people, some radical people. I just recently was on a Facebook site because I just joined up today, actually. And I was talking to Stephen Nance, and I posted an article on there. Not sure if it'll be common ground with the Tea Party, but I think it's important right now. But it's the call for a Wall Street sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the
you
idea
mean
is
the financial transaction tax?
Transaction tax, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gaining traction right now. I'm actually campaigning, full disclosure, with a group called the United Front Against Austerity. And we've been pushing for that name to be out there because there's a lot of groups that are pushing for a financial transaction tax right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, some of them are saying very low percentages. We're saying 1% on all transactions for people with assets that are trading with over $1 million in assets a year. That's just one part of the larger thing, because I think a lot of, since the economy is in such bad shape and no one can find work, things like that, I think that's really what we have to address at this point. And
mm-hmm.
a Wall Street sales tax is nice to keep things going, and it's really important. And, you know, we need it right now, because that, with the sequestration, you know, that could be a major issue for a lot of people who really depend on the programs.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
I mean,
great
you have
point,
to look
Chris.
Back to the 1930s and look with FDR. As much as people on the right don't like to do that, you know, we have to start up work programs again. We have to get the credit out there through the Federal Reserve to basically do the type of project that our country needs to get people back in the workforce and doing productive things.
Well, those are two great points. Rebuilding our infrastructure, investing in research and development, those are things that I think in today's polarizing climate we associate with the president and the Democratic Party, even though Republicans have supported infrastructure and research and development in the past. And the financial transaction tax, yeah, I hope there could be common ground with the Tea Party. They tend to see taxation in general as a form of government tyranny. But in North Carolina, where we spent a lot of time, it's very interesting because basically a Koch brothers type of person named Art Pope, a billionaire, put a ton of money into the recent election, and now has been appointed as a deputy budget manager by the new governor. And they just today basically gutted unemployment insurance. And one of the things that they would like to do is they'd like to shift the tax burden to the working class and poor and middle class by making the sales tax larger and having little or no income tax for the state of North Carolina. And I suppose that people are, you know, the Tea Party or the conservatives there are going to support that. But if you can support a little tax of, what, 8% or whatever, when you go and you buy, you know, a sweater, you know, at Sears, I don't suppose, you know, that you should think it's government tyranny to have a 0.25 or whatever it's going to be financial transaction tax every time a billionaire hedge fund whirs through all of these crazy schemes that most of us can't even understand. And another reason why I think it might be good to have the financial transaction tax is that it might put the brakes to some of that that insanity in Wall Street, because they'd be charged just a little bit of money every time they make a trade. So thank you very much for those points, Chris. We're going to go to 412 area code. We extended our time, by the way, so the show's not ending in 5 minutes. We're going to go until we've got all our calls in. 412 area code, let us know your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hey guys, this is Tom in Pittsburgh. How's everyone doing tonight?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, it's been a while.
Yeah.
All right, well, not to extend your call any longer, I'm going to be kind of brief, but this kind of goes back to what you guys were talking about a half hour ago, about whether or not collaboration is actually possible. And the thing that I really wanted to say is that, you know, if we wait around for everybody to agree with us, you know, nothing's ever going to get done. I mean, think about if we waited around to start the civil rights movement for everybody to agree with it, or even wait until the point that it's at today. I mean, would it have ever happened? Would it be, you know, 10, 20 years down the road? Who knows? My point is that we just really need to stand up for what we believe in and, you know, what we feel is right. I mean, somebody else on the other side that completely disagrees with us, that we completely disagree with, will stand up and they will talk about it. So when the decision is made about whether or not we're going to have, you know, hordes of money in our democracy or, you know, mindless corruption and senseless things going on, it's not going to be our decision, or we're not going to have any kind of say in it. I think it really goes without saying, and, you know, this is the, you know, best way to beat a dead horse is, you know, talking to everybody right now. But, you know, democracy is a participatory sport, and that's what we're doing right now, obviously. But, I mean, it's not a game. And it shouldn't be a game. There's not chips on the table, and there's not a ball on the field, and there's nothing. I mean, this is about our future. We can't let ourselves be drowned out because some people disagree with us, and we can't not be involved because some people are going to say that, you know, they think that we're wrong. And just kind of closing real quick, I looked this up a while ago while I was waiting, but Teddy Roosevelt was one of the greatest champions, I think, of, you know, the people versus the powerful. And, one of my favorite quotes by him is that it's far better to dare mighty things and to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much because they live in a gray twilight which knows neither victory nor defeat. So that's really all I wanted to say. you guys can debate that at will. Or...
Thank you, Tom.
No problem.
Annabelle, did you want to respond?
Yeah, no, I'm so glad Tom called in. Actually, we were having a conversation on my Facebook page a couple of hours ago because I put on my status, we need to end the war on drugs and start the war on corruption. And a lot of people seem to like that. And again, I think this is where you know, we can actually think about creating a movement as opposed to being so focused on what is dividing us. It's because I think, you know, it's that kind of thing where we know the war on drugs is a failure that we seem to just be stuck with, that we have to figure out how to put an end to it, and we have to figure out how to put an end to corruption. And so I think we can start to really think in terms of rallying people towards solutions instead of just getting stuck on what is dividing us. And I really want to also, you know, let people know that Tom made this great comment that we should just start running for office to show that people without big money can run for office. And that's a great spirit, a very American entrepreneurial spirit that we need to inject into our politics, because it's so easy to feel defeated when it just, you know what, it does come down to a few people saying, you know what, I don't care, I'm just going to run. I'm just going to do this. I'm going to speak up. I'm going to run for office. I would love to see more of that in what we do instead of getting too analytical.
Well, we have a 770 area code we're going to go to next. I just want to throw out there that a lot of people have said that if we could not focus on the issues that divide us, that we might be able to recognize what would be in the interest of our families, our futures, our mm-hmm. children. But you know, politics is a business, and it's very similar to the entertainment business, which is what I left to get involved in this kind of craziness. And conflict is what sells in both industries. And, you know, I'm not sure what was going through Diane's mind when she talked about the Civil War and how North Carolina was proudly part of the Confederacy and stuff. But I think a little bit of it was marketing, that she knows that she gets a certain amount of support and attention when she supports things like secession from the Union when you don't like the outcome of a presidential election. I'm not sure to what degree she actually believes that. She blogs, as I mentioned in the write-up, that her husband doesn't agree and that there's division within her household. So I guess that means she's pretty serious about it. She's willing to cause, you know, conflict within her home. But that's the thing we're up against here, is that, you know, Diane, who wasn't politically active until the 2008 election, the outcome, you know, disappointed her. She joined the Tea Party. And now she relies on these Confederate arguments. She's done all of this research about anti-federalism and all of the Calhoun argument in defense of states' rights and all of that stuff in order to basically amass this audience. And now she's, you know, she said she's very proud that people look to her for historical background, and that she's been appointed the deputy director of this, I forget what it was, some sort of constitutional think tank in North Carolina, and she has a title and she's so proud of it. So there's a certain reward when you go there, when you go to the stuff that's the most divisive. And honestly, I don't know if we'd be talking to or about the Tea Party if they hadn't used that kind of rhetoric in order to amass an audience. So let's see if our 770 area code has a remedy for that problem. 770, you're on the Middle Ground with Michael Charney, Eric Byler, special guest Annabelle Park. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
Hey, guys. This is Patrick Thompson calling from Georgia. I heard my friend Rodrigo on there earlier. We're down here in Georgia. I will tell you that, and I've been on here before, I ran for office here last year in Georgia. I have run in the past year. This is where the Tea Party is going. The Tea Party runs this state. And I fault some of our Republican people who have in the past been, you know, more middle ground, but for some reason are now so afraid because of a really small base of people that they can't speak out. They go along with the insanity. And here in this state, our representatives are really, and I go to all Tea Party meetings. I try to listen to their side of their viewpoint. Here in Georgia, like I think some states, they are completely a Republican funding outfit. They will only vote for Republican candidates. They don't listen to any other viewpoint. Even if they don't agree, that's where those people are gonna cast their vote. They are completely co-opted here by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange mm-hmm. Council. When I go to meetings, they are sponsored by lobbying groups like the American Enterprise Institute, Grover Norquist Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, Foreign Policy Institute. All of those are lobbying organizations. They're part of the problem. So the poor people, and some of them are fairly decent people, but they're getting completely snowed under by this corporate marketing message. It's part of the problem that I think Dick Garmey got in trouble for. That is the part that is the corporate part of the Tea Party, which completely consumes the message, whatever message the Tea Party might have wanted to have, being any having any semblance of independence or any modicum of discourse. It's here in Georgia, it's completely co-opted. It's gone. So it's really hard to build bridges, you know, between our organizations. There's no sense of, you know, I can't even use conservatism in their case because there's no conservatism really there. And I'm trying to be kind to people that I know, like are here on the phone, that are conservatives. That they're not conservative. They're definitely able to attract a group of people that are that feel displaced. They feel like somebody's wronged them, wherever that may be, and they're very easy to gravitate towards a message of hate and a message of, you know, hate the other guy, don't like the other guy. It's very right. easy for them to fall into that, and that's what happens here, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is Michael. You made a great comment when you said, and I appreciate it as a moderate slash conservative, however that quite works out, that in many ways the Tea Party shouldn't be considered conservative. The fact that their agenda is regressive in many ways doesn't make it conservative. In fact, the changes that are often proposed by, again, what I call the stereotypical or the co-opted Tea Party are some of the most radical changes this country would ever see if they were implemented. Every bit as radical as what happened in the New Deal. I mean, it would be that big a change to our society and our culture and our economy. And to call a radical change in any direction conservative is just not an accurate description of what it means to be a conservative. So I actually want to thank you for bringing up that point. It's one that often goes unsaid, but it's absolutely true. What the Tea Party proposes in many cases is not conservative. It's, in fact, very radical.
Well, one thing I did hear at the rally from Glenn, I think Annabelle said his last name was Bradley, was that if we, you know, he has a very strict interpretation of the Constitution. He says that really only he and the Ron Paul type of Republicans know what the Constitution means because they've read the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist papers. So whatever was ratified, that's one thing, but he has the tea leaves that and knows what the Constitution actually means because he read the works of the people who wrote the Constitution. And so even the Supreme Court is really, in some ways, he's saying the Supreme Court is off base when they, you know, he's very upset with the Obamacare decision, for instance, because really the states have the right to determine what the Constitution says. And one of the things that your comment, Michael, reminded me of is he said that if his interpretation of the Constitution were restored, then 80% of what the federal government does today would be unconstitutional, and so he'd be able to reduce government by 80%.
That's you've made my point, right? And by the way, I have literally at the end of my fingertips, copies of all those papers. I keep them on my desk. So he has no the fact that he's read them doesn't mean he knows them any better than I do or anyone else who, and by the way, these are in the public domain. They're not that hard to get a hold of, right?
You know what, Michael, next week we're gonna get Glenn on the show to talk to you.
I'll have to go back and reread some of the Federalist papers.
He knows his stuff. He knows his history as well as the African American gentleman Robert, the veteran who called in earlier. He knows his history just as well. He just has a different interpretation of it. So let's just take our final minutes. I want to bring Nicole back in. and see if she's, you know, she's kind of started off the conversation with her blog in response to the Tea Party video that we released today, to see if she's learned anything that she wanted to share. And then we'll see if Annabelle and Michael have an answer to my tough question from a few minutes ago. Nicole, you're back on with us. What'd you learn?
Hi, from this conversation. well, number one, it was reaffirmed to me that, yes, people who believe different things can talk. And also that we have a lot of work to do in terms of being able to really just sit down and figure out where we need to apply our sense of politics and where we need to apply our sense of personableness. You know, this conversation actually I think is classic in how we start about talking about, you know, one aspect of how to deal with each other, and we go off on many, you know, understandable tangents about specific policy. The one caller that sort of challenged Michael to defend his republicanism. And for me, that's the kind of thing that I want to be more conscious of, frankly, staying away from and getting around, because I think that if there's one thing, if we step back again from the details and look at the attitudes and look what this means on I don't want to say a higher level or a deeper level, but a different level, that what we have is a bunch of people who still want to try to connect. And the way that we know how to do that with people we disagree with is to fight with them. And in those conversations, we often come to them with this desire to win, you know, to get someone to concede a point or to have some sort of visible victory for what we were saying, and some kind of confirmation that we're right. And I think that if we can start letting go of that more, I think one thing that we need to remember is that we're going to be thinking about what we talked about here again and later, and that it's not so important to maybe drive or beat our points and our opinions home as to simply express them and give people a safer space to consider them without having to somehow make a big identity shift for accepting them at some point, you know?
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Nicole. Annabelle, you heard my question, right? Maybe
can
you restate it?
Yeah.
Oh, you want me to restate it? Okay. Well, I compared politics to the entertainment business, and I think it's pretty clear, especially on some of the cable news networks, that the two things have really fused into one. And then, you know, because marketeering has become so effective, advertising is so powerful, not just the political ads that the super PACs make, but the television shows that are really political ads masquerading as news, you have this polarization in part because the business model requires it. I know Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh have been pretty upfront about being showmen and businessmen. Yes, those consumer groups are marshaled into political advocacy groups like the Tea Party, but you know, these are just people who are consumers of products, and the products are going to continue as they are, and they're going to continue to dominate as long as television and radio have the larger share than the internet does, if not longer. So what do we do, Annabelle, if everyone here on this show pretty much agreed that the way to find common ground on economic issues is not to ask ourselves about what the real cause of the Civil War was before we get to it, just kind of actually skip that and let's talk about economic issues. But a lot of times we don't get there because the reason they're even in the room is that they read somebody's article about secession and they're really excited to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a slightly different framework that I use to try to understand our politics, which is that you know, so much of what we do in politics is to tell stories, and that you could argue that every movement in our history, it really has been about asking the question, who are we? And in the specifically in the American context, what does it mean to be an American? So every social movement or political movement provides an answer to that question. And Tea Party, I think, has been powerful to the extent that it told a good story and helped people to kind of have a sense of identity and a sense of self that often people are lacking in our kind of extreme capitalist economy. And I think that is one thing we can do as storytellers and as organizers, is to talk about politics in a way that quenches people's thirst for the American story. What is that story? What does it mean to be an American? Who am I? Asking those kind of existential questions that we do, because as human beings, we have to provide really good answers to those questions. And that this is why I don't like some of the labels that we often end up using, like Republican, Tea Party, Conservative, Liberal, all these labels, is because it inhibits our thinking and our and a kind of expansion that we need in order to have dialogue, in order to have growth and transformation. And so that's why I sometimes just basically say, let's talk as fellow Americans and see where we get, instead of approaching every conversation as a Republican, as a Democrat, or whatever you identify yourself, because you're already playing that game in a competitive way as soon as you do that. But if we approach it as we are part of one nation, we're part of one village, and we have to figure out how we're all going to live together. And just it just makes people think differently, and you play a different game. There are different goals, and it opens our minds to completely different answers. And so I guess that's kind of how I would present it, Eric, is like I'm not going to, like, I don't want to just adopt that framework. I want to ask you, what is the story that you want to tell about America? And what is it that, what is your answer to the question, like, who am I? And how do you help people provide really healthy and truthful answers to those questions?
Michael, Annabelle.
Yes.
Says all of that stuff about unity, and yet she's not one to back away from a conversation about the Civil War. In fact, a lot of our work, including 9500 Liberty, which is about immigration, but it took place very close to the battlefield on which the Civil War officially began, the Battle of Bull Run. There were undertones of the Civil War in the immigration battle that we documented. We're finding a lot of undertones, sort of not very well buried undertones in North Carolina right now with the way we've been documenting things. I mean, is there any good in reliving these conflicts right now, at least from our side, where we're trying to bring people together? We see that it's effective in the Tea Party organization, but for the rest of us, should we just kind of let it slide when they say that Lincoln was the one who caused the first shot at Fort Sumter, or should we challenge that? I know a lot of our friends in the African American community aren't going to really let us give people a free pass when they say things that are overtly racist. But if it's kind of that Southern education that Annabelle and I received about the Civil War, if it's stuff that we all just kind of grew up with, maybe we should just let bygones be bygones. What do you think?
So I almost wish I had John Cash on sitting next to me, who's become sort of my go-to guy for anything, any questions having to do with history. I don't think we should let it go. And I'll make a more general statement, and I'm not going to tie it necessarily to specifically the Civil War or specifically to race or specifically to the South. I agree with Annabelle. I agree with you completely, Annabelle. We create stories. We fill our lives with stories. We become stories. We tell stories. It's how we identify in the world. And our stories are filled with different chapters, and there's a chapter for me on being a Republican, there's a chapter for me on being a father, there's a chapter for me on the, you know, the what I don't remember about being at Berkeley in the 70s. These things make us up, and I think both individually and collectively, at the family level, at the community level, at the state level, at the national level, at the world level, these stories and the history that goes with them are important to remember, and they're important to get right. It's how you call somebody on things. So I'm kind of glad this came around, because I want to actually take a minute and maybe come back to where we started. And I want to defend Diane, who is the person that you interviewed, and we started the clip and at the top of the show. The truth is that her history is some of her history is fundamentally not wrong. So when she talks about, for example, the Republicans being instrumental in the civil rights movement or instrumental in bringing the blacks into full equality. She actually is right, but she doesn't know that she's right. She doesn't know why she's right. 80 years before Rosa Parks, Charles Sumner, a Republican, introduced and got a law passed that created equality. It created equality for blacks. It basically broke down any separations. All of the separate but equal laws were banished. Transportation was combined. Everything was combined. It was shortly after that struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. But it was a Republican effort. The group of Republicans at that time was called the Radical Republicans, and they were called the Radical Republicans because they wanted to give too much freedom. they were more liberal than the rest of the Republican Party. I think the danger is in the half-histories that are marketed to people in service of agendas. Right, and I know this is a long-winded answer, but I'm reminded of the story of Franklin Pierce, the only president, 14th president, the only president who ever came out of New Hampshire, who was a nondescript sort of nobody, not considered particularly intelligent, not considered a person who could ever have held the highest office, but he got the greatest marketing person in the world, a family friend named Nathaniel Hawthorne, to write him up, and wrote a book about Franklin Pierce and what a wonderful, great guy he was. And Franklin Pierce rode Nathaniel Hawthorne's marketing material into the White House. And so when you have those partial histories, those not quite right, don't sound quite right, ring a truth, people don't even know why they're wrong or why they're right, I think we need to correct those. And I think we need to work with a true history free of the marketing material that's forced down our throat and has been forced down our throat since the days of Franklin Pierce, so that we have objective, reasonable, logical reasons for the things that we believe.
Annabelle, any last words for the mm-hmm. show?
Yeah, you know, I, as you guys can tell, you know, I have very strong opinions. And so when I say I want dialogue, I don't mean that I remain like some psychoanalyst, like just completely neutral and I don't opine anyway. You guys all know I have opinions. But the reason why dialogue is so important is, I mean, I don't think we can really have a functioning democracy without dialogue. And I don't think that we think about enough the need for all of us to actually preserve the union. I know that sounds like antiquated language from the Civil War, but it is true. It's an active thing to be a United States, and I want to invite everyone to really think about it from that historical perspective, is that we all have a part to play. We have a civic duty to preserve the union and strengthen our democracy, and it is something that is a responsibility and a gift, and we can't throw it away because we get pissed off by something someone said, or because we feel like there's a list of things that we could complain about. If we see it from a historical point of view, we should feel like we have been blessed with gifts that have been bestowed by people who made tons of sacrifices. And so I would really like for us to think about it from that perspective and work hard to help preserve the union and to figure out sort of the mechanics of how we're going to do that. Okay, anyway, that's I'm going to get off my soapbox. Thanks
okay.
for the opportunity.
Thanks, Annabelle. Thank you, Michael and Nicole, Tom, Patrick, Greg, Chris, Robert. John, I know you wanted to get back in and talk about Glass-Steagall some more, but we're running out of time. We'll have you on next time, John in 908 area code. I thought his questions were good about military spending, although he did sound a little menacing. What did you think, Michael?
Well, you know, I always prefer to have time to prepare before I'm challenged that way. But no, I didn't find him menacing at all.
Okay,
not
I don't
all.
Know why. We've had other people call in, and often they were from the right side of the spectrum, who before they, I don't know what the technique is called exactly, but before you even begin the conversation, they try to pin you into something that they can attack.
You know, I know John didn't mean it that way, but I thought your answers were great. And actually, Tamara in the chat room put Michael Charney for president right about
that. That's never going to happen.
Okay, well, you want to take us home, Michael?
Yeah. So thank you, everyone, for great conversations. We'll do it again next week on The Middle Ground. I want to appreciate the thoughtful conversation from everyone. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you'll tell your friends to download it. And just as a last reminder, as you all know, the Coffee Party is a true grassroots, not a cliched grassroots organization, and we survive on the donations, small, large, medium, whatever you can afford, from our membership. So if you get a chance, please go to the Coffee Party homepage and become a member or make a donation. We'd very much appreciate that. As always, for anyone who become, not as always, actually, we're continuing the promotion for anyone who becomes a new sustaining member. That's a monthly membership for 1 year or more. To the Coffee Party, you will receive a free copy of my book, Tea with the Mad Hatter, as an e-book. Thank you, everyone, and we'll talk to you again next week.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow The Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.